Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard of Girls Gone Wild? Well, get ready for the hottest uncensored barnyard action of the year, Cows Gone Mad! We've searched the country's farms, feedlots, and abattoirs to bring you this exciting new video featuring this chart-topping song.
Moo, we're mad and wild cows, it's true. We could make you go crazy, too. We're putting you wise with this little tune. Between the two of us, cows will kick the bucket soon. It wasn't a surprise, I must say, when they called you SDA. Don't you know that I heard it through the bovine? Now we're treated worse than low swine. Moo, we heard it through the bovine. And I'm just about to lose my mind.
That's right. These cows are crazy mad. And they've got the tenderest loins on the lot.
Tails that look so fine.
Moo.
If our lives weren't brief, think what might have been. We'd be starring in Beauty and the Beef.
Our cameras capture Jersey's Angus and sexy young calves singing songs like I Feel the Earth Move Under My Feet. What's Cud got to do with it? And this tragic story of a man whose life ended way too soon.
One night while dining, a poor man was killed by a steak.
While out on the town with his wife, he made a mistake.
He had been drinking, so he wasn't thinking. He ordered filet for himself.
When the waiter asked, what about the mad cow? He said, she can order all by herself. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to eat cow meat. No sirloin on bones that are shaped like a T.
They'll get bovine sponge form encephalopathy.
Mama, your sons and daughters have all switched to cow meat.
They jumped on the Atkins low-carb diet fad.
And now their new diet just might drive them mad.
Order Cows Gone Mad today. And as a special bonus, we'll throw in another video for you fans of the full-figured heifer.
I ain't heavy. It's my udders.
It's not available in Canada.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to The End of American Exceptionalism with Andrew Basevich. You can listen to this at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can tune in to AxisSacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And the manifestation of that problem, I think, is all around us in ways that we have come to sort of take for granted and almost view as a joke. You know, the consumption, the culture of shop till you drop, dependence upon foreign energy with very little consideration of the consequences of that independence, of that dependence, rather, and so on. So one point would be that if you were surveying the landscape, and say, what are the two or the three or the four things that we as a people really need to focus on to worry about? I think the health of our culture ranks way ahead of the Taliban. So that'd be point number one. Point number two is, yes, with regard to U.S. foreign policy, I've increasingly come to believe that, although it is not that everything that every statesman since FDR has done has been wrong and stupid and reckless and a failure, that would be way too strong, that there have been an unacceptable number of failures and misjudgments that have cost us very dearly. The Iraq War is a recent example. The Vietnam War is another even larger example. Over the course of this period of U.S. foreign policy, post-World War II, one of the things that strikes me that, again, we've just simply come to, it's become part of the wallpaper of this country. We don't even notice it. One of the things that's happened is the extent to which U.S. foreign policy has become militarized. I mean, in the book I'm working on right now, I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about what I call the sacred trinity. The sacred trinity is the concrete expression of American so-called global leadership. And the sacred trinity, three items. One, that the United States must maintain a global military presence. Two, that the United States configures its forces not to defend the United States of America, but for purposes of global power projection. And number three, given this presence, given this capacity for projection, number three is a penchant for interventionism, overt and covert. That's what we do. And we have lost our ability, first of all, just to recognize the existence and the significance of the Sacred Trinity. We've also lost our ability to evaluate whether the gal dang thing makes sense. Does it make us safer? Is it guaranteeing our abundance? Is it guaranteeing our freedoms? I'm increasingly persuaded that the answer is no, that it's undermining our abundance. It's compromising our freedom. But I don't think we particularly notice it. You asked, are there ways to use American power positively? Well, yes, of course. American power has been used positively. I mean, the Marshall Plan was a stroke of great genius. The creation of NATO in 1949 was a necessary step. Why the hell NATO still exists today with our presence, I have no idea. In 1949, it was a wise and important thing to do. So yes, it's possible to use our power. It's not possible to use our power to remake the world in America's image. Now, is it possible to use our power, just got to the last part of your question, to sort out the Israeli-Palestinian mess? And I have to tell you, my answer is no. I mean, I think the argument that I hear expressed from time to time kind of goes like this. Jeez, we give the Israelis $3 billion a year in various kinds of assistance. I think mostly security assistance these days. So clearly that gives us a lot of leverage. Why don't we just use that leverage and say, look, either you're going to do what we tell you to do, I'm overstating it, or we're not going to give you the $3 billion a year. I have to say what I think they would say in response is, shove it up your nose. Now, why would they say that? They would say that, first of all, because they have a radically different view of the prerequisites of Israeli national security than we do. I mean, I'm not an Israeli. I'm not Jewish. All right? I am an American, and I believe profoundly that we have a vital national security interest in solving the Palestinian problem. But I can empathize with the Israelis, with Jewish Israelis, in light of the history of the Jews, in light of the history of Israel over the last 60 years, I can understand why they would be a little bit reluctant to say, oh, yeah, sure, let's create this nation state right next to us, and I'm sure we'll live in peace and harmony. Moreover, let us not forget the Israeli trump card. And the Israeli trump card is the Israeli nuclear arsenal. The Israeli nuclear arsenal exists, I believe, primarily not to serve as a threat or deterrent vis-a-vis the Arabs and the Iranians. I think that the principal purpose for the Israeli nuclear arsenal is to make sure that we won't abandon them. The ultimate threat that the Israelis have, the leverage they have on us is, go ahead, abandon us like the Jews have always been abandoned, you Americans. But understand, we're not going to go down without a fight. Understand, we have the capacity to blow up the whole friggin' Middle East. And it is that, I think, concern, prospect, that makes it all that much more difficult and unlikely that we would try to use the leverage that some people believe that we have. And I say that it makes me very sad to say that, because I see no resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And many of you know that there are a variety of demographic factors that are sort of in play that, in fact, are going to add further layers of complication to the situation that already exists over roughly the next 20 or 30 years. And this is one of these things where I just feel like we're on some arc of tragedy where nobody has the answer. Yes, sir. And
What do you like about being an, what do you like about being an American?
What do I like about it?
Oh, man.
I like the values in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution. I like the fact that I can come to Philadelphia and say whatever I want to say and engage in a dialogue with people. I love the fact that I, as to be a university professor is a truly a privileged position. I get paid pretty good money. I get to teach young people, which is a tremendously stimulating profession. And when I'm not teaching, they let me do whatever the hell I want to do. And that allows me to write. So I think that the freedom that I am permitted is, that's just something that I cherish very much. Yes, ma'am. Okay, well, after this one, we'll go in the back because all the people in the back are getting mad.
Lambs. He told me to believe on Jesus, stole the money from my hand. Well, some say he was a good man, Lord, I think he seen me. Took his best friend in Saigon. Lawyers took his wife. This kid's no regret, son. In a time I don't remember, Lord, and a war he can't forget. He cried, forgive me for what I'd done there. I never meant those things I did. Give me some to believe in. There's a Lord above. You give me some to believe in. I said, Lord, all right. But this ain't my lonely man. Some Palm Springs hotel room. I got the call last Christmas evening. They told me the news. I tried all night not to break down and cry. As the tears roll down my face, I felt so cold and empty, like a lost soul out of place. And the mirror, mirror that's on the wall, see my smile fade again. Give me something to believe in. To believe in, I give you something to believe in. All right. Sometimes I wish to God I didn't know now things I didn't know then. Oh, road you gotta take. Drive by, homeless, sleeping on a cold, dark street. Like bodies in an open grave. Underneath the broken old neon sign, he used to read, Jesus says. A mile away, there's the rich folk, and I see how they're living it up. While the poor, they eat from hand to mouth, rich drink from the
makes me wonder. So many lose, so throw away. Give me something to believe in.
Give me something to believe in.
Now give me something to believe in.
Give me something to believe in.
Help me sing it, Charlie.
Something to believe in.
I know. I said, sweet Jesus.
Something to believe in.
To the end of American exceptionalism with Andrew Basevit.
Do you think it's going to be possible for Obama to listen to some of the more peace-oriented people? And if so, what should we be doing to get him to listen?
No, I don't think he will listen. I mean, I think that when I was trying to describe the sacred trinity, this consensus, I think. Again, I'm not expecting that everybody would sort of buy this, believe it, but my own view is that this national security consensus, this belief that global leadership, which we feel that we are called upon to exercise, nobody else can do it, this belief that global leadership requires a global military presence and global power projection and a pattern of interventionism is something that the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats subscribe to. I mean, let's think about the election of the 2008. I don't mean Obama versus McCain, but the entire long, drawn-out primary season leading up to their nomination. There were two candidates who stood outside that consensus. There was one on the left, and there was one on the right. Who was the one on the left? Kucinich. Who was the one on the right? Ron Paul. How many votes did they get? Zippo. Matter of fact, it wasn't that they got simply Zippo. Maybe this is a little bit unfair, but my sense is that each guy's party treated him as if he had some kind of dread disease. You know, we don't want to get too close to Dennis Kucinich. We're going through the motions of letting him be on the platform, but oh my God. And both of these guys were sort of treated by the media as, you know, not quite jokes, but not someone whose views should be taken seriously because they were outside that consensus. So for peace and justice groups to have an opportunity to, I think, really have their voice heard, they have to crack that consensus. Again, speaking as a historian, and I've been thinking a lot about this lately because of what I've been writing on. You know, when I was I served in Vietnam toward the end of the war, 70 to 71. And I'm not sort of, you know, dramatic war stories, but it was a pivotal event in my young life. And I certainly believed then, and I suppose I believe now, that was one of the pivot points of contemporary American history, the Vietnam War, and everything about it, the war itself, the opposition, and so on. And yet, when you think about it, with regard to national security policy, what's striking about Vietnam is how brief and trivial its effects were. I mean, Saigon falls in 75. By 1980, 5 years later, I mean, that's a blink in history. We have elected Ronald Reagan president. We've elected Ronald Reagan president because Ronald Reagan is the guy that says, by God, we need to rebuild American military power. By 1990-91, with Operation Desert Storm, the brief reluctance to intervene is swept aside. Remember George Herbert Walker Bush's famous comment in 1991, well, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome, which was quite true. I mean, the lid comes off of interventionism from 1991 going forward. So in my point of that sort of narrative is to suggest how difficult it is going to be to get people to question the consensus, how difficult it is going to be to have somebody who runs for high office, who stands outside that consensus, and still get them to be treated respectfully and as a serious contender for power. It's just a steep hill, I think. So, yes, sir, all the way in the back next to the door.
Two more questions.
In the 1950s, President Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, a lot of what you alluded to as far as the loss of democracy. Don't you think it did come to fruition?
Well, yes and no. I'm always a little bit wary about talking about the military-industrial complex because I mean this directed at you personally, but I think there's a lot of people who want to find a simple answer to our troubles, and the military-industrial complex is an example of a simple answer. You know, it's this, in essence, I know you didn't say this, you know, in essence, it's this dark, shadowy conspiracy, and these people hijack our policy, and there we are, innocent Americans being taken advantage of. I think that way overstates the case, and the problem, of course, is if you blame the military-industrial complex, then you're sort of saying, it's not my fault. And going back to my point about a cultural crisis, I think in many respects, if you're not happy with foreign policy, most of us need to own up to the fact that we own a piece of what we're not happy with. The second thing, though, also is that although it's absolutely true that if you're looking at the percentage of discretionary spending on the part of the federal government, the defense budget's still a big chunk. I mean, defense spending this year is somewhere around, again, nobody knows, probably somewhere around $650 to $700 billion. Having said that, defense spending is actually far less significant, either as a proportion of the economy or as an overall part of federal spending than it was back when Eisenhower was leaving the presidency. We are only spending about 4% of GDP on defense right now. I think during the Cold War, the average was 10% of GDP. I was just reading something earlier this morning. In 1946, right after World War II, the defense budget was 36% of the federal budget. So the point would be, yes, the military-industrial complex is important. Number two, it's not as influential, I think, as it once was in terms of clout. Number three, it's really not, I think, a proper explanation for our problems. It's a bigger explanation required. I have not done a good job of gender balance, and I would like to ensure that the last question was asked by a woman, preferably one in the back, but there's none in the back. So, yes, ma'am, right here. You have to wait for your microphone.
You know that you reenacted a John Stewart scenario earlier when you did sort of a man on the street. What do we know about Iran, and what do the people on the street know about us? And, of course, we knew nothing, and people on the street in Iran knew unbelievable things about American history.
Who's funnier, him or me?
Him.
In other words, don't quit my day job.
So I guess my... And this week, also, I've been gifted by hearing a woman... Trudy Rubin from the Inquirer talk about education and education in the Middle East. And I guess my sense about Barack Obama is I pray that his domestic agenda, and I wonder what your thought as an educator is about this, that if we were all more informed about history and about other cultures and if we spoke other languages and if we had a greater understanding of our world, maybe we wouldn't be in the situation that we are in today.
I'm all for it, but I cannot help but be struck by the extent to which, for whatever reason, we tend to be a fairly provincial people. I also am struck by, I have to confess, we educators have a fairly limited effect on people. Not because I think we're lazy or stupid, but a person's outlook is shaped by a host of influences, and what you read for some course or what you hear in the classroom is only one influence among many. I teach courses in U.S. foreign policy, among other things. And there's one thing that the average BU student knows coming into one of my courses. You know, the average sort of 19-year-old young kid. One thing the kid knows about foreign policy, and that is that U.S. foreign policy breaks into two chapters. And chapter one goes from 1776 to, just to pick an arbitrary date, December 7th, 1941. And the label on chapter one is isolationism. And then there's chapter two. And chapter two is called global leadership. And I spend a whole semester just trying to bludgeon these kids into being open to the possibility that the story of the United States between 1776 and 1941, remember 1776, 13 little colonies, 1941, From Sea to Shining Sea, that maybe something was going on during that interval other than isolationism. And we get to the end of the course, and I ask a question, and I ask, you know, the question, what do you think of isolationism? And then they will very conscientiously write down, isolationism is a myth. We learned that this, you know, and then they get their grade and they leave. And I think 15 minutes after they leave my course, they know that there's two chapters in the story of American foreign policy. Why is that? I don't know. This has really been terrific. I'm very grateful, and thank you very much.
Many people have been upset about the public funding of pornographic art. We have with us tonight Senator Jesse Helms to touch on this sensitive area.
This senator will comment on a problem I've seen. The government is funding art that's really obscene. Naked things incense me, stimulate and tense me. Never hold those big, enormous things against me. Well, the problem here, boys, is that your statue needs a tutu.
Ooh, ooh.
Gotta confess, somebody give her a dress.
Way to go, Jess, give her a dress.
Pardon me, sir, but what's the matter if they're too loose? One will do a baby picture of you.
We've got a couple dozen photographs of Senator Hart. They show from every angle, every bodily part.
This one I'm rebuking.
I'm the fella who can tell you that's a photograph of poor Buzz Lucan.
Pardon me, boys, but all you statues here are too nude.
Woo, woo.
That was Senator Tar before he ran out of power.
Mr. Tower,
but all us artists have a message just for you. We'd like to do what you do. We'd like to censor you too.
Censor you too, censor you too.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.